content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated August 18, 2025. The cover is bordered in red, as usual, with a narrow white inner border. Time is in gradations of off-white to grayish-brown. Time is in capital, large block print lettering. The portrait on the cover is of a man. It is Speaker of the House Mike Johnson. He's wearing a dark suit, white shirt, dark tie. He has graying hair, very neatly combed back from his face. He wears glasses. He's looking askance at the camera with a very slight grin. Beginning with the first article, under The View, Society, Beach Nation, by David Litt, L-I-T-T. Growing up, my family skied. We hiked. While no one would ever have described us as mountaineers, our vacations nearly always involved verticality. What really made us mountain people, though, is that we were not beach people. On its face, what set us apart was elevation, but really the divide ran much deeper. In the mountains, you pick a point and work hard to get there. If you are hiking or climbing, the goal is above you. If you're skiing, snowboarding, or mountain biking, the goal is below. Either way, in the mountains, a sense of satisfaction and wonder come through hard work and achievement. You earn your views. Beach people, on the other hand. Well, I did not really get beach people. I understood beach activities, boogie boarding, body surfing, fishing, but just hanging out on the sand, sitting on a rickety chair in the shade of a flimsy umbrella with nothing but a book or human being for company, that did not seem merely strange to me. It seemed scary. The Jewish Talmud refers to sleep as 1/60th of death. That's more or less how I felt about hanging out at the beach. And so, as fate would have it, I fell in love with a beach person. Jackie grew up 10 minutes from the Jersey Shore. We were 25 years old when we met on OkCupid in its 2011 heyday. I cannot point to the exact moment when I began to feel kind of beachy, but in a way, that is the point. A beach day is not about discrete moments. It's about time melting into itself. It's one of the few instances when, "Where did the time go?" can be asked with delight rather than regret. That is especially true in America. In a country that fetishizes productivity, the beach celebrates the absence of achievement. It gives a quiet, content middle finger to our workaholism. In its own laid-back and lackadaisical way, beachgoing argues life's most valuable reward is not a yacht or private jet or invitation to hobnob with the rich and powerful. It is extra time and the chance to spend it with people you care about. In a country in the grip of income inequality, that is a remarkably egalitarian view of luxury. For most Americans, the beach is also the country's most accessible public land. Many of our most pristine woodlands, or peaks, are deep in the wilderness. That's part of what makes them pristine. The beach is different and far more densely populated. While coastal counties make up less than 10% of the lower 48 states' land mass, they are home to 40% of its people. For many American families, sun and sand are the most affordable nature around. And in our often privatized and commodified country, beaches remain surprisingly accessible. There are reasons to be concerned the number will shrink. But for now, in both law and theory, the beach belongs to everyone. Nor has access devolved into yet another red versus blue issue. California and Texas like to present themselves as polar opposite visions for America. But one thing they have in common is that the public has a legal right to access the beach. That is one reason why, while the fantasy of a private beach remains the prevailing one in beer commercials or posts from travel influencers, in real life the beach is increasingly a melting pot. Nationalists like Stephen Miller suggest, when people from different backgrounds share the same space, the inevitable result is chaos. The beach belies that. That's especially easy to see in New Jersey, the most densely populated state in the country, and one of its most diverse. When people from vastly different groups hang out at the beach, what happens is pretty simple. They enjoy themselves. That's not because they're trying to prove a point about multiculturalism. It is because if you're not enjoying yourself on the beach, who even are you? We actually do not have to divide ourselves into mountain people and beach people. We need both, and if we're lucky, we get to be both. One night, almost a decade ago, Jackie and I went to Long Branch, New Jersey, on July 4. We staked out a spot on the jam-packed sand and laid out our blankets. There were at least a half dozen languages being spoken, but no translation was needed. We sat together, chatting in anticipation of the fireworks, enjoying a quintessentially American experience. After the last boom echoed over the shoreline, everyone went their separate ways, but not immediately. There was a moment when all of us, thousands of us, lingered and listened to the ocean. We sat there on the edge of the infinite, each of us knowing that for a moment, anyway, we had all the time in the world. David Litt, who wrote this article, is author of It's Only Drowning, a true story of learning to surf and the search for common ground. And there's a photo here, not even a quarter of a page, and it's very faded looking. I don't know if it's vintage. It's not dated. But there's a skyscraper or tall building in the background. It looks like it's on top of a hill with trees intermediate. And then finally in the foreground, the ocean and the beach. Crowds enjoying the shoreline along Santa Monica, California is how it reads. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer. This page-long article features an inset photograph in color. It is of Russian President Vladimir Putin in St. Petersburg, July 26. He's looking like he's thinking about something. His hair is quite nearly bald, with a bit of blondish hair graying at the temples, and he's resting his chin on his left hand and looking at nothing one can discern. He's wearing a dark suit, white shirt, and dark tie. Ian Bremmer is contributing editor. July 28, President Donald Trump signaled growing impatience with Vladimir Putin by telling reporters in Scotland Russia's president must halt the fighting in Ukraine within 10 or 12 days to avoid sanctions and secondary tariffs, tightening a 50-day deadline he set earlier in the month. But this latest threat is unlikely to change Putin's plans. From the outside, it is hard to see why the war continues. Putin, the one person who could bring it to an end, can see Russia has paid a steep price over the past 3 years and 5 months to gain just 20% of Ukraine's land. By some estimates, Russia has suffered more than 1 million battlefield casualties, with a 250,000 killed. The war has strengthened NATO, which Putin says is Russia's true enemy, by bringing in new members and persuading European governments to spend much more on defense. Since the invasion, roughly 1 million young Russians have fled the country to avoid conscription, find better job prospects, or both. Though scaling up, Russia's war machine briefly boosted its economy, the long-term loss of energy customers in Europe, a surge of inflation that has pushed interest rates to historic highs, and a deepening reluctance among Russian consumers to spend leaves Russia's economic future on dangerous ground. How hard would it be, outsiders wonder, for Putin to cut a deal, stop the bleeding, declare victory, consolidate Russia's gains? But Putin believes time is still on his side. In the coming months, Russian forces will probably gain enough new ground in Ukraine's east to keep him committed to a strategy of maximum pressure to wear away at Ukrainian resolve. Drone and missile strikes on Ukrainian cities and infrastructure will continue because Kyiv has not found a way to stop them. Russian forces will apply more pressure in other regions to further thin Ukraine's defenses. That's enough to persuade Russia's president to stay in the game. Not that Volodymyr Zelensky's ready to offer concessions. Ukraine's president is weakened domestically by a failed attempt by his government to leash a corruption watchdog that had begun growling at his political allies. Even if he were stronger, Ukrainians have absorbed much too much Kremlin-inflicted pain to offer concessions substantial enough to satisfy a Russian president who will likely want more. Nor will Ukrainians trust Putin and future Russian leaders to honor the promises they make to end the fighting. Trump does not have the leverage to change any of this. There is not enough direct trade flow between the U.S. and Russia to credibly threaten. But he's warned of possible tariffs on countries that trade with Russia. Yet Putin has good reason to doubt Trump will pick new fights with China and India, now Russia's two biggest energy customers, particularly as Trump works to lock down big trade deals with both countries. EU sanctions will not alter Putin's calculus. The main tool in Europe's 18th sanctions package against Russia, an adjustable oil price cap, will force Russian oil exporters to rely more heavily on the shadow fleet of tankers they have used to evade the cap. But without U.S. support, their impact will not amount to much, and the EU has little ability to slow Russia's defense sector. Nor is Trump's ability to pressure Zelensky as potent as it appeared just weeks ago, because the ever-changing, seemingly contradictory tactical approaches to both Ukraine and Russia suggests the U.S. president might again change his mind. Putin and Zelensky are also aware Trump has many more demands on his attention at the moment. There is one other possible reason Putin might prolong this increasingly costly war of attrition. Perhaps his confidence in continuing the war is one more item on a lengthening list of his strategic mistakes. The invasion itself was a spectacular miscalculation of both Russian and Ukrainian strength. Perhaps he is not making a deal because he still cannot see how much Russia has to lose. The View essay. Society. Women are meant to be strong, by Anne Marie Chaker, C-H-A-K-E-R, who is a journalist, professional bodybuilder, and author of Lift, How Women Can Reclaim Their Physical Power and Transform Their Lives. This article will probably be abridged. This summer, I will step on stage to compete as a professional athlete for the first time at 50. I will wear a fuchsia bikini, small enough to fit in a Ziploc bag, pose and flex in clear heels, and strike a smile while my muscles glisten under layers of spray tan. I am a bodybuilder. This is my third season competing, but my first as a pro. I came to the sport 6 years ago after a string of losses, the death of my father, the end of my marriage, and a spiral into depression and alcohol. A spontaneous conversation with a woman in a hotel gym set me on a different path. Soon I found a coach, a retired bodybuilder in Bowie, Maryland, named Tina Peratino, who flipped everything I thought I knew about fitness, food, and the female ideal. First, women should eat more and better food. Second, carbs won't make you fat. And above all, lifting heavy won't make you bulky. It will make you powerful. I had spent decades chasing thinness, eating less, running more, trying to shrink. But in my new orbit of athletes, powerlifters, and bodybuilders who embrace the moreness of muscle, I began to want something different. Lifting heavy and eating more, not less, reshaped not just my body but also my mind. I stopped craving alcohol. I spoke up more at work. I stood taller. I even made a dating profile and met my partner. The shift, better food, heavy weights, little to no cardio, was so transformative, both physically and mentally, that the journalist in me had to dig deeper. I spent 4 years researching the science and history of women's bodies, the overlooked power of muscle, and while the real answer to better health, longevity, and quality of life lies in building, not shrinking, ourselves. What I found revealed muscular strength is a vital, long-overlooked key to women's health and longevity. We have been taught to disappear, but our true power lies in taking up space. Women were never meant to be thin. When anthropology professor Alison Murray was studying prehistoric human remains at the University of Cambridge, she made a startling discovery about women's bodies. They were buff. When comparing prehistoric women with modern ones, Murray found their bone structure most closely resembled that of today's elite rowers, evidence of regular load-bearing activity, and a sign that women played a major role in the development of agriculture. In fact, for most of human history, women were not meant to be thin. They were meant to be strong. Neolithic women had arm bones 11% to 16% stronger than those rowers' arms, and up to 30% stronger than typical Cambridge students, according to a 2017 study. Bronze Age women showed a similar pattern, with arm bones up to 13% stronger than the rowers. Our cultural obsession with thinness is a relatively recent invention, born of fashion, patriarchy, and post-war consumerism. When food became more accessible, especially in Western cultures, thinness replaced fullness as a marker of status and self-discipline. It began in the late 19th century with new warnings about corpulence, the dawn of dieting as a moral virtue, and the invention and rise of the calorie, all of which paved the way for modern food restriction. Today, the conversation around longevity, especially among men, is booming. But despite the manosphere's headline-grabbing blood swaps, women quietly hold the real advantage when it comes to living longer. Across time and cultures, women have consistently outlived men by 5% to 20%, says Stephen Austad, scientific director of the American Federation for Aging Research. The global life expectancy at birth for a woman is 76 years, compared with 71 for a man. About three-fourths of centenarians are women. The reasons are not fully understood. Theories include the possibility of a more responsive immune system, an additional X chromosome, or the idea that mothering makes women robust, but the pattern is clear. And when it comes to strength, women possess a different kind of power. Yes, men typically have more upper body muscle and larger hearts, but studies show women are often more resilient. Sandra Hunter, chair of movement science in the School of Kinesiology at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, has found women can better withstand muscle fatigue. In fact, Hunter points to a 2016 review of more than 55 fatigue studies that concluded, on average, women outlasted men by 36%. The emerging science paints a clearer picture. Women are not the weaker sex. We're just built differently and to last. Bursts of the return to skinny have always surfaced at pivotal moments, right when women are on the brink of claiming more power. It is no coincidence. The flapper look took hold in the 1920s, just as women won the right to vote. A new boyish silhouette for a new kind of woman, one who was suddenly politically powerful. In the 1960s, Twiggy, with her thin, androgynous frame, became the face of fashion, right as the women's liberation movement was gaining traction, challenging traditional roles and demanding equality. In the 1990s, heroin chic surged in popularity as women flooded law schools, boardrooms, and newsrooms in record numbers, a visual counterpunch to female ambition. And now, at a moment when women are redefining aging, owning their midlife, and fighting urgently for reproductive autonomy, the rise of GLP-1 weight loss drugs feels eerily familiar. Each wave of skinny fixation has echoed like a cultural recoil, a shrinking aesthetic that emerges just as women expand their influence. But something is shifting. This time, resistance is coming from midlife women, especially those in menopause, who are rejecting the idea their power fades with age. The menopause industry, fueled by a range of supplements and other products, is now estimated to be worth over $17 billion. Gyms are taking notice. Crunch Fitness, with over 400 locations across the U.S. and a membership that is 55% women, is cutting its supply of cardio machines in half to make room for free weights. Lifetime Inc., a chain of upscale health clubs, reports a one-third reduction in cardio equipment in favor of weights and resistance machines. Orange Theory Fitness, whose members are three-fourths women, has introduced strength-only classes alongside its signature cardio and strength blends. Peloton, too, has launched Strength Plus, a standalone app untethered from its iconic cardio machines. When she catches herself envying a thinner woman at the gym, a woman says she reminds herself what she can do by throwing a heavy weight over her head. And I'll say, but can she do that? That article was slightly abridged. Turning the page now to the View inbox, Health Matters by Alice Park, senior correspondent. In a study published July 22 in Nature Communications, researchers report living through the COVID-19 pandemic aged our brains, whether or not you were infected with COVID-19. Researchers looked at brain scans from 1,000 people during and before the pandemic. They compared these with brain scans from other people taken during normal times as a model for typical brain aging. The pandemic-era brains aged about 5.5 months faster compared with the brains of those studied before the pandemic. The accelerated aging was documented in people who had COVID-19 infections as well as those who did not. Other studies have showed the COVID-19 virus can change the brain for the worse, but we found participants who simply lived through the pandemic period, regardless of infection, also showed signs of slightly accelerated brain aging, says Ali Reza Mohammadi Nejad from the University of Nottingham School of Medicine in the UK, who led the study. This highlights the broader experience of the pandemic, including disruptions to daily life, stress, reduced social interactions, reduced activity, etc., may have had a measurable impact on brain health. It is not clear from the study what effect the faster aging has on brain function in different people. While the researchers reported faster brain aging in men, the elderly, and people with more compromised health, lower educational status and income, or unstable housing, only people infected with COVID-19 showed drops in tests of cognitive skills. The DC Brief by Philip Elliott, senior correspondent. Over the third weekend of July, a lot of institutional Washington suddenly and enthusiastically discovered James Talarico, T-A-L-A-R-I-C-O, a seminary student and member of the Texas State House. The find came during an impressive outing for the 36-year-old Democrat on Joe Rogan's podcast, in which the aspiring preacher espoused the same brand of sharp sound bites that has earned him almost 1 million TikTok followers. Over more than 2 hours, Talarico explained why a Texas law requiring the posting of the Ten Commandments in public school classrooms is unchristian, how coming political fights won't be about left or right, but rather the top and bottom of society, and how both parties get it wrong when they treat politicians like messianic figures. James Talarico, you need to run for president, Rogan said. We need somebody who is actually a good person. For For now, he is seen as a dark horse candidate to challenge Senator John Cornyn's already dicey re-election bid in Texas, where a scandal-soaked Attorney General Ken Paxton may plausibly land an endorsement from Donald Trump for his primary challenge. Paxton is ahead in polling and better liked among Texas MAGA base, but Cornyn, who's held his seat since 2002 and is still a power center in the upper chamber, is seen as a stronger candidate in the general election. But to zoom out, the last time a Democrat won statewide in Texas was 1994. A year before Windows 95 hit the market. Texas is in a record dry spell. The 48% of the vote Beto O'Rourke won in his 2018 Senate campaign set the recent high water mark. And to his credit, Cornyn is a far less divisive figure than O'Rourke's opponent, Senator Ted Cruz. And to his credit, Tallarico sounds different from the partisans in Washington. I think we need to start listening to Democrats who are in red and purple areas. There's something about living in a red state that makes you different from a national Democrat who lives in a blue city on the coast. I think we learn how to talk with people outside our party in a more effective way because it is a matter of political survival out here, Tallarico told Rogan. I cannot pass anything in the Texas legislature without getting Republican support, so I have had to find ways to build relationships and build bridges across partisan divides as a Texas Democrat. His study of theology is not a natural fit in the secular Democratic identity of late. His fluency on digital platforms may mesh neatly with a relatively younger cohort of Democrats who finally seem to be meeting voters where they are on social platforms, while the old guard clings to a 1990s playbook rooted in TV ads and postcards. And Tallarico is so far outside the splash zone of partisan Washington that he might just be able to stand unstained by its ugliness. After all, Barack Obama went from the Illinois State Senate to a national ticket in 4 harried years. But that so many Democrats spent a weekend obsessing over a relatively unknown in Austin, who represents about 200,000 people in a deep blue district, shows the extent of their desperation. In The Loop by Billy Perigo, correspondent. You can measure time in the world of AI by the cadence of new essays with provocative titles. Another one arrived in July from the team at Mechanize Work, a new startup that is trying to automate all human labor. Its title, Sweatshop Data is Over. The essay points to a very real trend in AI research. To summarize, AI systems used to be relatively unintelligent. To teach them the difference between, say, a cat and a dog, you would need to give them lots of different labeled examples of cats and dogs. The most cost-effective way to get those labels was from the global south, where labor is cheap. But as AI systems have gotten smarter, they no longer need to be told basic information, the authors argue. They say AI companies are now desperately seeking expert data, which necessarily comes from people with PhDs who will not put up with poverty wages. Teaching AIs these new capabilities will require the dedicated efforts of high-skill specialists working full-time, not low-skill contractors working at scale. It is true that the big money has indeed moved toward expert data. A clutch of companies, including Mechanize Work, are jostling to dominate the space, which could eventually be worth hundreds of billions of dollars. Many of them are not just hiring experts, but are also building dedicated software environments to help AI learn from experience at scale, in a paradigm known as reinforcement learning with verifiable rewards. It takes inspiration from Google DeepMind's 2017 model, AlphaZero, which did not need to observe humans playing chess, and instead became superhuman just by playing against itself millions of times. In the same vein, these companies are trying to build software that would allow AI to self-play with the help of experts on questions of coding, science, and math. If they can get that to work, it could potentially unlock major new leaps in capability. All of this, however, does not mean sweatshop data have gone away. We do not observe the workforce of data workers in the classical sense decreasing, says Milagros Micheli, a researcher at the Weizenbaum Institute in Berlin. Quite the opposite. Meta and TikTok, for example, still rely on contractors all over the world to remove harmful content from their systems, a task that has stubbornly resisted full AI automation. Other types of low-paid tasks typically carried out in places like Kenya, the Philippines, and India are booming. Right now, what we are seeing is a lot of what we call algorithmic verification, people checking in on existing AI models to ensure they're functioning according to plan, Micheli says. The funny thing is, it's the same workers. If you talk to people, they'll tell you, I've done content moderation, I've done data labeling, now I am doing this. And here's the page with seven questions. This is the question-answer format. Today it's written by Megan McCluskey, and Benny Safdie, S-A-F-D-I-E, is the subject, the actor and filmmaker on playing the baddie in Happy Gilmore 2, his UFC movie with The Rock, and training for Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey. First question, you wrote about your love for the 2024 animated film Flow, F-L-O-W. Would you ever make your own kids' movie? Answer, definitely. I want to be able to experience a movie that I made with my kids and talk to them as an audience. I think there's something really special about that. Question, what was your relationship to Happy Gilmore before taking on the role of the sequel's villain? Answer, it's one of my favorite movies of all time. I can close my eyes and see it from beginning to end. Adam Sandler is just special. It's crazy to me that I'm even in this thing because that movie was such a big part of my childhood. Question, what did you most want to bring to the character of Frank Manatee? Answer, I wanted him to be one of those people you swipe past on Instagram and are like, oh, I know that guy. He speaks in broad platitudes about how to succeed. He's an energy drink disruptor. I wanted to make him as real as possible because that's one of the things I think is really successful about Shooter McGavin, the first film's villain. I was able to bond with Shooter actor Chris McDonald about how these guys don't think they're bad. They just think they're doing what's necessary. Question, how would you describe your your creative relationship with Sandler? Answer, there is a real affection. It's one thing to work with him as a director on 2019's Uncut Gems, but to be in a scene with him is amazing. He's such a perfectionist. There was one line we were really trying to hammer home. Will you stop with the shoe? We're done with the shoe. We did it so many times. We had a very specific cadence. We're both after the same thing, which is doing whatever it takes to make it as funny as possible. Question. Your next directorial effort is The Smashing Machine this fall, which stars Dwayne Johnson as UFC champion Mark Kerr and is already generating Oscar buzz. What was it like working with The Rock on this dramatic role? Answer. We both saw something in Mark's story that we connected to. It was almost nonverbal. I could see how passionate he was, and I felt the same. I could ask him to do anything, and he would pull it out like it was nothing. He had a lot of respect for Mark and his wife, Dawn. There's a UFC tagline my wife got me on a shirt, "As real as it gets." We took that to the extreme. Question, how do you decide where to focus when it comes to acting versus directing? Answer, if there's something I really want to do, I'll figure out a way. I was editing Smashing Machine while I was acting in Happy Gilmore 2. I had my laptop out in my trailer when I was not working on scenes. It was the same with The Odyssey. I was editing when Chris Nolan called me and was like, "How's your body?" And I was like, "What do you mean? Like, how's it holding up in the edit?" And he says, "No, I want you to be in this, and you have to be in better shape." So I was exercising and thinking about what I was eating, then coming back and finishing Smashing Machine, all while dressed as Frank with that hair and goatee. Finally, question. As a director, do you take notes from the great filmmakers like Nolan, Claire Denis, and Paul Thomas Anderson, who have directed you as an actor? Answer, 100%. There are certain things that will ignite something in me. I think it's about being willing to put yourself out there. There is a vulnerability. I was going to speak with a Hungarian accent in Oppenheimer, and Chris's implicit trust gave me the confidence. Paul will gently try to get you in this competitive headspace to be the best you can be. Claire is always searching for something exciting. She'll stand up in the middle of a scene because she wants to be excited. When somebody's doing it right, there's kind of a through line to it. Next, there's a double-page photo spread. It's in color. The title of both the photo and the coming article is The Gaza Strategy. The Gaza Tragedy, pardon me, it is The Gaza Tragedy. A UN-backed body says plummeting access to food has left ordinary Gazans facing famine. The article is by Carl Vick. The photograph is by Ali Chadala. The caption of the photograph reads, "Palestinians wait for food aid in Gaza City, July 22. The background is a blue sky, pale blue sky, uninterrupted. The foreground is a fence or a gate. It looks metal to me. Crammed, elbow to elbow, shoulder to shoulder with women. The women are wearing mostly long-sleeved dresses. One here has a bracelet on. Most of them are wearing head coverings that match their dresses, but not all. There are some children peeking through this gate or fence. All of the women are holding either buckets or very large pans, like cooking pots, or large pans that you might wash your dishes in. They're holding them out, and they're looking intense. Some look like they're struggling. Some look like they're desperate. None of them looks happy." So now to The Gaza Tragedy by Carl Vick. This is a long article. It might be abridged. If any place had experienced seeing civilians through the war, it was the Gaza Strip. It is much of why the place exists. That stretch of Mediterranean coast was only even named while being demarcated as a refuge for Palestinians driven off their land by Jewish forces in the 1948 war that created Israel. Gaza's permanent status, like the fate of the Palestinians, was never decided, however, and as the decades churned on, so did the conflict. There was a devastating rhythm to it. Palestinian militants launched missiles into Israel from Gaza. Israel's military replied with airstrikes, at times with sustained campaigns dubbed wars. The longest lasted 50 days. In each round of fighting, civilians knew where to find safety: in the schools, clinics, and hospitals run by the UN, which also fed them. Nearly all of that has been destroyed in Israel's response to the horrific Hamas attack of October 7, 2023, though not only by bombardment. In its war on a terrorist group, Israel also dismantled civic structures that support an entire population, with the bonus of undercutting the UN. Israeli distrust of the UN runs deep. Most of its member nations support the Palestinian ambition for a state of their own, and in 1949 it set up the architecture of one. That was the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East, or UNRWA. As its administrator, Philippe Lazzarini, put it, the Israelis got a state, the Palestinians got UNRWA. With 13,000 employees, UNRWA was Gaza's largest employer. And after October 7, Israel charged that a dozen of them took part in the attack. One was videotaped loading a body into an SUV. Asserting that UNRWA was as riddled with Hamas as Gaza was with tunnels, Israel cut relations with it in January. In March, as a ceasefire with Hamas fell apart, Israel shut down aid from all international aid agencies, collapsing a fragile but professional humanitarian apparatus that had kept 2.1 million residents fed. No food entered Gaza during March and April. In May, Israel declared it was taking over aid distribution itself through what is called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Aid groups lamented it reduced the number of food distribution points from 400 to 4, and that at about the same time, Israel launched a massive new offensive. The result now, the worst-case scenario of famine, is unfolding in Gaza, according to the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, IPC, a consortium of leading aid agencies. The IPC is, in effect, the world's hunger watchdog. From sub-Saharan Africa to the Middle East and beyond, aid groups take their cues from its determinations about food needs of communities caught in natural and man-made upheavals. Though it stopped short of formally declaring famine across the strip, the warning was the humanitarian world equivalent of a four-alarm fire, and it galvanized global opinion. That's real starvation stuff, President Donald Trump said. After seeing images of wasting children on television, you can't fake that. Such is the elemental power of mass starvation. Its specter can overnight reframe a conflict that already has cost 60,000 lives and fueled tense global debates on morality, anti-Semitism, the laws of war. When children are starving, the enemy is hunger. We know what to do about that, and doing it carries benefits beyond saving lives. In Gaza, addressing famine means sanctifying life instead of normalizing violent death. the meaning of a war that over 21 months threatened to be buried under endless mountains of rubble now becomes about facts, the kind found on a medical chart, like the levels of magnesium and zinc in a patient, depleted electrolytes being among the first signs of starvation. Soon the body breaks down fatty acids to create the fuel to function, then proteins, finally cells. Fighting famine calls for a mobilization, but not one that can be effective on a battlefield where since May more than 1,000 Palestinians have been killed while traveling toward aid. This kind of mobilization requires not only a steady supply of basic foodstuffs for the merely hungry, but also high-calorie, nutrient-rich pastes, therapeutic feeding centers for the acutely malnourished, dedicated clinics for pregnant women, clean water, and sanitary regimes to prevent cholera. All the infrastructure of life-saving aid that a concerned world rushed to erect in Sudan, in South Sudan, in Somalia, the only other places famine has been declared in this century. In Gaza, all that will amount to restoring a measure of what already was there just 2 years ago. Not the buildings, but the structures of mutual aid that constitute the core of civic life. It is what Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar, who was essentially prime minister of Gaza, threw into the fire when he concocted the October 7 attack. The next move is up to Israel, which within living memory was known less for its military might than for its ingenuity. This is the country that with drip irrigation produced the miracle of growing food in the desert. There are a few other photos here that I will read the captions of for you. Lined up here are men, some dressed in more traditional Arab long robe dress, some in regular street clothes that you might see at the Food Lion or the mall. All have their arms folded in some way, either hand over hand or arm over arm. They are looking at something on what appears to be a gritty, sandy surface, the ground. There's a blue sky in back, but it's just a little box. It's a little white box. Maybe it's wicker with a white blanket inside. The photograph is by Mariam Daga. Prayers over the body of Zainab Abu Halib, who died at 5 months from malnutrition-related causes in Khan Yunis, July 26. And one more. There's a line of 2, 4, 6, 8 people. I think they're all men. They appear to be all dressed in grubbies, sweatshirts and dark trousers. Some are wearing vests. I'm wondering if the vests indicate what organization they're with, but I can't see the backs. So they're standing in front of what looks like a really crummy fence. It has horizontal slats with kind of chicken wire stuff at the top. All of these men, or each of them, is standing in front of a huge cauldron over a fire. They're all lined up. And the caption reads, "Volunteers prepare meals from donated food over wood fires in Gaza City, July 30. That photograph is by Abdalkam Abu Riosh. Another photo here. This is a pretty nifty-looking place. It looks like a really clean room. Walls are painted in shades of pink and white. There's a yellow balloon attached to one wall, and that wall features a mural of a child. It's in black and white, the mural, but it's of a child among flowers and butterflies. There are 1, 2, 3, 4 women either standing or seated here. And This photograph is by Abdel Karim Hana. The women are all dressed in the traditional long robe of the Muslim women with headgear, and each of the women is holding a baby. These all look like little babies, like 3 to 6 months old. Mothers and babies at a malnutrition clinic in Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis in the south of Gaza, May 1. And one more photo here. This is by Abdalkem Abu Riash. Well, it's a crowd is what it is. It looks like a crowd of men and boys, although I do see perhaps a younger woman with longer hair in the crowd. Most of their heads are not visible. Most of their faces and heads are not visible, just the shorter children are. They're all carrying pots and dishes. The pots are like a large cooking pot that you might make a stew or chili in. And the caption reads, "Lining up for a hot meal in the Al Zaytun neighborhood of Gaza City, July 31. It's a mob. You cannot see, you cannot slide a piece of paper between these people. Here's Time Off Reviews. This is one of the 100 best podcasts, according to Time. Home Cooking in 2020, Sami Nasrat, the bubbly and impressively knowledgeable chef who won a James Beard Award for her debut cookbook, Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, teamed up with veteran podcaster Hrishikesh Hirway to answer questions from cooped-up listeners like what to do with all the beans we stocked up on during the pandemic, or how to cook a vegetarian Thanksgiving. The duo's light, pun-filled conversations have now returned ahead of the publication of Nasrat's second book, Good Things. Samin is spelled S-A-M-I-N, and Nasrat is N-O-S-R-A-T. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.